Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your patience. We'll just say we're not running late because we didn't put any times on the presentation. We've learned from past practice.
We understand when you have a group of people together, but it's not a problem. We're glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Colleen. There's a few new board members who may not be familiar with Angelo Gordon and kind of what they do, how they do it, a little history maybe, a quick history lesson, and then go on to your new fund.
Great. No, we're happy to do that. Nice to see so many familiar faces and meet the new members as well. My name is Colleen Casey, and I work in the Marketing and Client Servicing Group at Angelo Gordon. And joining me is Reed Lifman, and Reed is the co-portfolio manager for our U.S. real estate funds, and today we'll focus on AG Realty Fund 9. And Reed's been at the firm for about 4 years, but has a very long history with the firm, having been one of our operating partners, and that term will become very familiar during our time together. We put together a presentation for you, and per Brian's request, I'll tell you a little bit about the firm. Because it is bigger than real estate, but how we built our platform helps us execute our business. And happy to take any questions that you have along the way, and then I will transition to Reed to talk about the real estate market, your investment in Fund 8, your prior fund, investment with us, and talk about opportunities you're seeing.
One housekeeping. On the booklet that you handed out, it's marked confidential, not for further distribution. This is an open meeting. It is available to the public, so I assume you waive confidentiality.
Yes, we actually, I know we're back and forth in the team here at Contra Costa was fantastic working with some of our legal team. So,
great.
Yes, we understand what we sent to you, the nature of that.
Okay.
So thank you, Brian. But directing you, if I may, to page 2, Angelo Gordon this year is celebrating its 26th anniversary. John Angelo and Michael Gordon, the two founding partners of the firm, are still 100% involved. Today we have about 70 partners at the firm. We're privately owned, so Reed, myself, and 68 other people are the owners at the firm. We have about 300 and change employees, if you will. I think we're a little over 300 now. About 110 investment professionals, and we have a number of different strategies at the firm, but if you really look, there's two core strengths. It's credit and it's real estate, and then we have kind of different flavors within each of those. And if you turn to the next page on page 3, you'll see the evolution of our business. When the firm started, we were doing more credit-related strategies, and then about 21 years ago, started investing in opportunistic real estate. That's been a great springboard into other real estate business to include Core Plus, real estate, investing in Asia and in Europe. So we can touch a little bit of that during our time together. And then on the credit side, starting with convertible arbitrage, distressed debt, leading us into more the securitized business, RMBS, CMBS, net lease. So our businesses are very cyclical and also limited to how much money we can raise. We're always looking to find complementary strategies that have good interplay. What do we have, what do we do, and then how can we expand that and really leverage off that? Because one of the things we're most proud about is our culture, and we feel it's a great strength of the firm, and our culture really begins and ends with we all work for one firm. There are a number of different strategies, people have different responsibilities in each strategies, but yet we are a 330-person firm, 110-person investment team, if you will, and all those different people can talk to one another. So these businesses that we've added really add to the strength of the platform. To the next page, it's really a breakdown. As I've mentioned a couple of times, the credit and real estate strength of the firm, you can see where the assets are. We're managing today about $27 billion. But we are in a great position as a firm because we don't wake up on January 1st and say, we need to grow by 20%. We want to grow by X percent. These are our objectives. We match money with opportunity. So when we go out and raise a fund, we look at what the opportunity set is. So when we were sizing Fund 9, Fund 8 was $1.25 billion. Reed and Adam Schwartz, who's the co-portfolio manager and head of the team with Reed, they've done such a great job along with their team that they had the capability of raising $3 billion, but the market wasn't there. So they decided to raise $1.5 billion. The position we're in, we are able to be that selective. So the market is dictating not kind of the growth that we want to achieve. So we feel that's you know, helped us to be able to have great alignment with our investors and deliver consistent returns. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have on the firm and then turn it over to Reed. But the one thing I would note is that being a 26-year-old firm, 80% of our clients are institutional. And we're very proud of the fact we work with about 50 public pension plans like yourself. And I feel like we have a good understanding of your objectives. I feel we really are great partners with these plans to understand your needs, to hopefully be a great resource to all of you, and understands the needs as we structure these partnerships. So it's something we're proud of. And we also work with six California counties. So my time in Sacramento has paid off, which I'm thrilled about. It hasn't been all just fun. But from that standpoint, so we're very proud to be, you know, a 15-year member of Sacramento and working with you again. And, you know, many thanks for giving us the opportunity to update you and share with you our new fund offering.
Thanks. Are there any questions? Well, thanks for, I was here, I guess, in July, and I appreciate the opportunity to be back again and to talk about what we're doing, what we've done with for you in Fund 8, and our view of the real estate world, and a little bit about Fund 9. So we'll flip through this presentation. I'm not going to cover every slide, but I can cover anything. If there's anything that I skipped that is interesting to you, please let me know. Quickly walk through review of the strategy, which most of you are pretty familiar with, I would guess, and then get into the specifics of your existing Fund 8 investment. Walk through a couple of recent deals, which is really the best way to illustrate what we're doing and how we're executing. And then I want to just cover the market really briefly, and then we'll hopefully leave some time for questions. So starting on page 8 of the book, these are the keys to how we approach the business. First one is probably the most important: focus on value creation, not financial engineering. What we are a bottoms-up real estate investor. We're not macro-driven. We don't make a decision to allocate to a specific product type versus another product type. We look at real estate assets one by one, generally, the occasional portfolio, and pride ourselves on the ability to be able to identify properties that are underperforming for a variety of reasons, sometimes underperforming and over-leveraged, identify those properties, come up with a business plan that can fix them during our ownership, fix the properties, create stable cash flowing assets, and then sell those assets to core buyers or buyers looking for long-term income streams. That's our business. To do that, we apply pretty conservative underwriting. That has held us very well, held us in good stead very much through the downturn, where our attention to relatively low leverage, not cross-collateralizing, using realistic assumptions, not overly aggressive, not counting on growth rates when there is no growth, allowing for cap rate compression, all the things that we do as a matter of course helped us do very well relative to many others in the downturn. We tend to focus on major markets. We like major markets. It provides liquidity, and for the types of assets and the size we want to do, we want to primarily be in the larger markets.
Before you leave that page, there might be a place to bring this up. When I was learning to drive, this could be a short story, and I was barreling toward an intersection that had a green light, my driving instructor introduced me to the concept of a stale green.
Mm-hmm.
So could you touch on the extent to which you leverage? On your page it says modest leverage.
Right.
You just said relatively low leverage.
Right.
But some preliminary work we got suggested that it might be 50-70%.
Right.
Gives new meaning to me to be modest and low.
Right.
And if there's a stale green out there with regard to the Fed and what might happen with rates, what might that mean to your prospects of being able to finance future investments?
Right. We target leverage of 55-65%. In this fund, which is on the lower end for if you look at the opportunistic vehicles. Right now, the fund, Fund 8, is 51-52% leveraged, so we've been at the low end of that scale. We've bought a fair number of assets unleveraged. Some opportunistic investors are much more willing to take higher leverage because today, frankly, that leverage, as you're pointing out, is cheap. And they make the argument it's cheap, it's being subsidized, however you want to talk about the interest rate curve that we're dealing with, it's relatively cheap capital, and so maybe makes sense to put more leverage on. And that, in a lot of ways, is driving some returns. I'm going to get to the and the problem with that is if that stale green light turns yellow or then red, what happens? And so we've always been, in the real estate world, on the lower leverage across our funds. Fund 7, the fund before this, was in the 40% leverage, even though we can go 55 to 65%. And our view on leverage is keep it conservative. Don't cross collateralize.
Does everyone know what that means? I just want to make sure that we're clear.
By cross collateralizing, meaning we buy one asset and we will finance against that asset. We're not going to take multiple assets or even at the fund level and put financing on, to then it effectively you are pledging more equity than the one asset. You could, and what got people in really big trouble in the downturn is that some funds not only bought heavy leverage at the asset level, they bought this building and then put 80% leverage on it. Then sometimes they took all those assets, wrapped them up in a fund, and then put leverage on at the fund level, thereby crossing everything. And so when they got in trouble, they lost a lot of assets all at once. We don't do that. We're very stringent on guarantees. We're very stringent on recourse. As far as rates, we expect them to go up. I can't tell you when. We've expected them to go up for a while. So far, we've been wrong, but we will be right someday. I'm not going to predict when, but we, you know, in our position, all you can do is run your business like rates are going up. They're going to go up, and I know, having done this long enough, when they start going up, you know, they can go up very quickly. And so that means we're widening out our cap rates on the back end to assume those rates go up, and specifically, we're fixing our interest rates either through swaps or caps when we borrow money. So long answer to your question, but hope I covered it.
And factoring that in our underwriting.
Yeah. But you're hedging.
We're hedging, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So now going to page 9, we hire people that have real estate experience. We pride ourselves in being able to know a good building from a bad building, understand what makes a good floor plate versus one that doesn't work. A lot of people on the team have heavy real estate experience. I brought about 25 years of direct real estate experience, hands-on, working with assets, acquiring assets, developing assets to the team, but others have very significant experience. We hire those kind of people as opposed to ex-bankers primarily. And to supplement that, we use what's known as the operating partner model, meaning we seek to go out to various markets throughout the country, find the people that we think are the best local entrepreneurs in a given product type and given geography, and seek to form partnerships with them. We'll go and find someone that we think is very good at multifamily in San Francisco. Help them, they help us find deals, we help them find deals, we underwrite them together, and we form ventures on a deal-by-deal basis where we put up the majority of the equity, they co-invest, they get modest fees for running the assets along the way, and then hopefully, if the deal works, they're promoted on the back end with an incentive payment. And that's the model that we've used for 20 years. We have 50 active partners now, and they're a very important part of our business and a key to our success. The map on page 10 shows you the coverage of our operating partner universe, and no surprise, most of them are coastal markets. I'm going to skip page 11 other than point you to the bar chart, the one bar chart where it says opportunistic. There's a green bar and a blue bar there. What that shows you, what this data shows here, is what we were able to do with the assets when we own them. We look at this as a very important factor. There's been a lot of money made in the last couple of years. Some of that has been made by people doing good real estate deals. Frankly, some of it's been made by the fact that the capital markets have recovered so much. As investors, you need to be looking at your managers and saying, what can they do going forward to improve the real estate assets, to actually make the money by doing something to the asset? Because we've had a lot of recovery behind us, and you don't necessarily have those tailwinds anymore. This chart on page 11 basically shows, in the blue bar, what the assets that we acquired were yielding at acquisition, about 4.5%. And then the green bar shows that what we were able to do through our leasing, repositioning, renovation efforts, what we were able to increase that yield to, and you see about 10%. The difference is the spread we created. So we built something to about a 10% yield, and then we're able to sell it at a 5, 6, or 7% yield to investors, and that's where the profit was made. The key thing there is that you see, in a low interest rate environment, which we benefited from, we were still able to create very considerable value at the asset level, and that is the key to our business and the key going forward. Our returns are on page 12, the opportunistic series. You can see your fund, last one there. These are as of March 31st, and it shows a projected IRR of 23%. We just completed our June projections, and we're now projecting that at 24%. Overall, our opportunistic fund series has been very strong, excellent performance over many years and many cycles. Fund 6, a fund that was invested pre-downturn, very, very difficult vintage, our worst performing fund, but yet is projected at a gross IRR of 5%. That's way below our expectations, but it's going to be at the very, very, very top of the class. And I also will point out it's real. 106% of that money has been returned to investors, which puts it again at the top of the class. Page 13 is the team. A lot of longevity here. Blue is New York. Green is the West Coast. People come with us. They stay with us for the long term. We tend to hire young associates that then learn the business, learn the AG way of doing things, and stay with us for a very long time. We've had really no turnover in the last 2.5 years other than one analyst. It was a mutual, actually was a mutual. He left. And we had one VP leave that went to a hedge fund that was starting a real estate effort. Otherwise, very consistent team. 14 summarizes what our objectives are for this next fund. 20% gross return, leverage 55 to 65%, typically hold assets for 3 to 5 years. Any questions on that quick overview before I get into a recap of your Fund 8 investment? Okay. So now I'm on page 17. Fund 8, 2011 fund, $1.25 billion. You committed $80 million. These numbers are again as of March 31st. I'm going to give you the updated numbers. We've now called just shy of 75% of the capital and have committed about 90% as of today. And we've returned about 16% as of today, as opposed to the 10% that's shown here. And we have a number of other pending sales in the works right now, so that number is going to move up. We've invested, closed 55 deals, and have 4 under contract as of this, as of today. And leverage is at 51%, as we said, and again projected IRR of 24%. The fund, each one of our investments is laid out in the next 3 or 4 pages. The fully realized transactions only show 3 of them because, again, this is of March. There's 2 more subsequently. The portfolio is doing very well. It's well diversified across office, multifamily, retail primarily. We have 2 hotels in there, a little bit of storage, a couple of residential deals, 1 condo deal, but most, the highest percentages are office and multifamily in coastal markets. And overall, portfolio is doing very well at this point. Okay, I can. If there's no questions now, I can walk through a couple of recent deals. Does that work for everyone?
Sorry. Mm-hmm.
Page 25 now. This is interesting because a lot of investors are asking us where deal flow is coming. The world has changed since 2011. What this does is summarize everything we bought in 2013 across both of our strategies. You can see we put $550 million to work in 2013, about $327 million of it in opportunistic and 13 transactions. And interestingly, 3 of the deals were acquired or involved a lender. So about 30% of what we 20-some percent of what we did involved a lender. 3 years ago, that percentage would have been 50%. That's been one of the changes in the U.S. market. lot fewer of our deals are coming from lenders these days. There's still a lot of deals that are over-leveraged, where the equity's out of the money, where they need capital to deleverage, but less in the U.S. are coming directly from the lenders. Different story in Europe, where half of our deal flow, or maybe more, is coming from lenders, and that's just because they're much further behind in the distress cycle. You can also see where we acquired assets, mostly in coastal major markets. The biggest thing on deal flow now is that you need, there's nothing that's really thematic about it. You're looking at a lot of different deals. You need to have good sourcing. We buy a lot of our deals off market, as you can see, 14 of the 22 off market or busted process. We don't like to win competitively marketed deals. Occasionally we have an angle on a deal, we have a different insight that makes that okay, but that's not what our business is about. And that's important today because you need in this environment to be able to look at a lot of deals, identify things that are broken that you can fix. You're not going to be able to make money buying an index of real estate over the next couple of years. Couple recent deals. Georgetown Park is a deal that we just sold. It's kind of a classic Angelo Gordon deal. We bought a very well-located, underperforming retail center that was located in Washington, D.C. Actually, the last deal I did as an operating partner before I joined AG, I acquired it, and then someone else took over the operations. We bought it from a bankrupt lender. It was essentially vacant. It was in some very difficult litigation, but we saw some really great intrinsic value here, ability to renovate this and reposition this property. This is what we like to do. We like to buy things that are really broken and fix them as opposed to ground-up development. And the reason for that is if we buy it broken and fix it, we can be in way below replacement cost. New development, you can't do that. We acquired it, cleaned up some of the problems, completely reconfigured it, released it. We bought it for $59 million and spent another $90 million renovating it, built it to about a 9% yield on cost, and then recently sold it to a core investor at a 4.4 yield. This deal generated a 37% IRR and just shy of a 3 multiple, over $100 million of profit. Columbia Center, this is a deal, one of the deals that's in your fund. Office buildings by O'Hare Airport, you can see that plane that's there. It's flying over the buildings adjacent to O'Hare. We bought this from a fund/lender, Anglo-Irish, paid about $60 a foot for it. It was decently leased when we acquired it, but had a fair amount of leasing to do and also had a rent roll that had some problems. We saw an opportunity here just to be able to give this asset a little tender, loving care. It had been in a situation where the lender was out of the money, the owner was out of the money, everyone was losing money, no one was paying attention to the asset. And we saw an opportunity to clean it up and do some leasing. We did just shy of 300,000 square feet of leasing during our whole period, built it to about an 11% return on cost. This is under firm contract for sale now to a Canadian investor. A $9 million hard deposit, it will close in October. And we tend to be conservative in our projections. This shows a 24% IRR and a 1.8 multiple. The IRR based on the hard contract will be mid-30s and 2.3 or 2.4 multiple. And then finally, a more recent deal, 360 Michigan Avenue. This, we hope, will become the next Georgetown Park. This is, again, another iconic asset in Chicago, great location, great bones. Currently an office building. Our plan is to renovate it and reposition it as a 4-star hotel, do a complete heavy gut job to it. It's what AG is very, very comfortable with, underwriting, assessing the risks, making sure we're getting paid well for those risks. We like this deal, again, because we are going to be able to develop a hotel, be all in, about $300,000 per key, and that compares to $400,000 or maybe even a little bit more to build ground up new construction in Chicago. So we like having that spread. How are we doing on time?
You're fine.
Okay. Finally, there's some slides on the market here.
Do you have an operator in the hotel?
Yes.
And
yes, Oxford. Oxford Capital.
What's the masthead for the hotel?
We do. We have one identified. We're negotiating the thing, but because this is, it's not fully signed yet, so I don't want to put into the public domain until it's...
Would we recognize the name?
Yes, it's a major name. You'll definitely recognize it. You'll probably have an affinity card, too.
No tell motel.
We're not counting on it, but we think fundamentals, which have not, for the most part, been a big positive factor in real estate performance. It's been a lot of what you can do to the asset, in our view, what we've been able to fix. It's also been capital flows. Fundamentals have lagged, and that's because GDP has been slow and employment, or slower than typical, and employment growth has not been what the typical recovery is. We do think we're at the point in the cycle where we have kind of some suboptimal, but GDP growth at 2%, whatever they're calling the new normal today, and we've had consistent employment growth, getting employment back to pre-recession levels. And what that is going to do, and we have a lot of visibility because we have big portfolios and see a lot of assets, it's improving absorption, it's improving rental rates across most markets in the country. Up to now, improvements in office have been primarily concentrated in three or four major markets. We see it spreading. Possibility that that could be a nice tailwind to what you to what happens here is the improved fundamental picture. We don't need it, but it could be an added benefit. The reason why an improvement in employment and GDP is probably going to have a more pronounced effect than typical at this point is because we have produced very, very little new supply of real estate product in the U.S. with the exception of multifamily. And the lack of new supply is giving assets the chance to stabilize, and it's going to allow owners to probably move rents up. Typically, going into a downturn, you typically have too much new supply. You go into it with new supply. You come out of the downturn, you got to burn through all that new supply before you can even start getting some stabilization. This chart, you've probably seen it in other presentations. The red bar shows the historical new supply that's been built in America over a about a 30-year period. Excuse me, yeah, 30-year period. And it's about 2%. And you can see, remembering back to the RTC days, the early, late 80s, early 90s, look at how much new supply preceded that downturn. And even a little bit of new supply preceded the mid-2000 bust. But going into the 07-08 bust, the biggest problems were heavy financial leverage that was driving the real estate markets, LBOs, all kinds of really highly leveraged structures. It wasn't new development. So we went into it without a lot of new supply. We came out of it without a lot of new supply. And very little has been added so far through the cycle, with the exception of some markets where there's some multifamily. And I will say San Francisco, that I took a run around this morning, and that's one exception. There's a lot of office buildings going on in San Francisco right now.
I see a lot of cranes over there.
Yeah, there's a lot of cranes, and it's a little scary because rents are peak, and we'll see. So that's a positive backdrop, and it shows up on page 32, where this is kind of a collection of forecasts of what is going to happen to NOI during the next couple of years.
Yeah.
And you can see that they're all sloped up. Everyone's projecting that net operating income at real estate assets is going to go up. That's a factor of GDP, employment growth, no supply, and the fact that we've just had such a slow recovery. We can skip the next couple pages. Let me just talk about one thing on page 36 that I think is interesting. So there's nothing thematic, really, 35 and 36. There's a lot of data on this, and you can take a look at it later, and we'd be happy to, if anyone has specific questions on it after, I'd be happy to address them. There's nothing thematic going on in the U.S. now with the financial sector like there is in Europe. In Europe, the banks are being forced to liquidate. They're in a liquidation mode. They're way behind. We do see one thing that could become thematic where we've been accessing some deals, and that is the fact that there's still a fair number of loans that were done in the 2006 and 2007 time frame and then securitized. Real estate loans are typically 7 to 10 years. We think that there's a lot of loans that were put into securitizations, securitized 2006, 2007 were horrible underwriting years. The underwriting was very aggressive. There was no amortization. They assumed only the best, and then the worst happened. And so a lot of those loans that are in those so-called securitizations are now in special servicing. And a lot of those loans, as they come to maturity in 2015, 16, and 17, are going to be faced with the fact that they need significant equity to deleverage. And because the equity has been out of the money and unmotivated, probably have not been invested in the assets. And so we have acquired assets like this out of these securitizations from servicers where they just haven't had money for TIs, they haven't had money to improve the asset, they haven't had money to pay broker's commissions. You can't pay the broker commission, it's not surprising you don't get a lot of tenants. And we think that there, thematically, there may be an opportunity to do a fair amount of deal flow out of those structures over the next couple of years. So we do think that's interesting. And what you see on these charts is just the maturity wave. I won't get into the details because it's a lot going on here. The maturity wave that kind of hits 2016 and 17. So with that, I'll turn it over to Colleen to kind of summarize the fund, and then we can answer any questions.
Perfect. If I may direct you to page 40, we can review the terms for this fund. As I stated earlier, our objective is to raise $1.5 billion. The term is a four-year investment period, four-year liquidation period. The management fee is 1.5 during the commitment period and 1.5 on net funded capital. We are offering a fee break for investors of $75 million or above, and what that will entail is the uncalled capital will be at 1% versus 1.5%. So just want to make note of that. And the carried interest is 20% to Angelo Gordon, subject to a 9% preferred return and a 50% catch up. And AG commitment is 3% up to $15 million. So we, you know, hope we have provided a good overview of our strategy and the firm to those of you that aren't as familiar with Angelo Gordon and those that are. Hopefully it was a very helpful update on your investment with us, and it's a great pleasure and honor to be here today, and we do really appreciate all the work that's done into bringing people in. So we hope we've answered questions, and we're always available, obviously, for our remaining time, and then afterwards, if there's anything else, we can help clarify or explain. But again, many thanks.
Great. Thank you, Colleen.
Any questions?
Anybody on board yet?
We are doing our first closing on October 10th, and we have about $800 million soft circled for the fund, and many existing investors in the earlier funds have committed already to date. I don't know what the exact amount's going to be of the first close, but our goal is to have the fund committed by the end of the year and a final close early next year.
Thank you.
Yes.
Excuse me. Two questions on page 40. Where the fee break occurs at $75 million range, and we're talking about 1/2 off unfunded capital commitments. Would you give an example of what that is?
So if you commit, let's keep a simple number, $100 million.
Okay.
So that $100 million, until we call it, is at 1%. Once we call that capital, it's at 1.5%. So it's a different... You know, the management fee is lowered for the larger investor capital that's not called, and we have 4 years to call that capital.
Okay. The other one is the 50% catch-up described, and how does that work?
So you get all of your capital back. So again, let's use the $100 million example to keep it simple. You get your $100 million back, and then we need to deliver the 9% preferred return. And then at that point, we split the profits 50, so we get our 20. And once we get our 20, you get 80% of the profits, and we get 20 after that.
How does the 50% come in?
So as an example, like just to keep the math, let's assume we did $100 million, we drew it all the first day, okay, 100, and then 9% a year, not getting into compounding, that'd be $9 million a year. So it was 5 years. So you would need $145 million, $100 million of your principal, $45 million, you know, the $9 million a year for 5 years to come back to you, and then after that, the catch-up would kick in after you had the $145
million. Well, okay, and the 50%, what would happen if you're at $50 million?
You mean, if you...
I'm trying to figure out, and I still haven't got a clear idea, how does the 50% work as contrasted to it doesn't work.
Wait, you're saying...
Where did the incremental dollars go after $145 million?
Okay, after the 100, then it goes 50-50. So the next $1 million would go 500,000 to you, 500,000 to us, until we have caught up to a total of 20% of the overall profits.
So that's what 50% means.
The catch-up. Right. It's the split.
All right.
So you have the $145 million. That's in your pocket.
All right, we get that first. Yeah. Okay.
And then the next dollars until we've caught up, till you look at the total dollars, you get till we've had 20, a total of 20% of the profit total, it goes 50-50, and then it goes back to the 80-20
split. So if it were 100% to you, you would get all of the next increment of funds until you got your 20%. Instead, right. You get half of that, we get half.
Right.
That would be, 100% catch-up.
All right. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for coming all the way out here to see us.
Our pleasure. Always good to see all of you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you.